Well, dear brethren, we're looking forward to Brother Tim Krupa's service at this time. And Brother Tim has entitled his thoughts, "Sir, We Would Like to See Jesus."
Good morning. I have totally enjoyed being with you. And we have known each other for a long time. And as I look around the room, different parts of my life pass before me, including time spent in Poland. That's where I met some of you for the first time. And I'm just going to mention the memory that goes back the farthest. Okay? When I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, my parents would go to the meetings, and on Monday night, I can remember so distinctly, and on Wednesday night, we would go and pick up two young sisters and help them get to the meeting. And it was Verna and Virginia Talwinski. Virginia Talwinski later became Virginia Rawson. And so that's a good memory. It's emblazoned in my mind. And I'm going to say something risky here, and I'm going to say that, Sister Virginia, we want to acknowledge the great day you celebrated yesterday. It was your birthday, I believe. But don't go up to her and ask her, you know, how long ago that was or anything like that, okay? Anyway, I used the title that came from an incident that's recorded in the 12th chapter of John. I'm not going to talk about that incident. I just wanted to use that title. And it's where the some Greeks came up to one of the disciples, it was Philip, and they said, "Sir, we would like to see Jesus." And that concept of seeing Jesus, I think, is paramount. And we do get excited about, you know, some of our logical endeavors and some of our delving into scriptures and Strong's and Young's concordances. But friends, the bottom line is, we must see Jesus. And there's one chapter that sticks in my mind. I call it the perfect chapter. And I call it perfect because it's the 7th chapter. And, you know, we kind of have that, here we go again, I'm right back to numbers. We have that, the number 7. It kind of, you know, we see that, we say, oh, that's a good number. Perfect. So I think in this 7th chapter, there are 4 perfect stories that we get to see Jesus as good as it gets. And I'm not going to argue with you. If you tell me about another incident, you say, well, this was a great one too, I'll say yes. I'll say yay and amen. But the fact that these 4 are all in the 7th chapter, I think, is kind of special. I suppose I should mention which 7th chapter, huh? Well, it's by our good friend Luke. And, you know, Luke, by profession, was a physician. And he seems to enjoy telling the stories of the healings. I think he must have just naturally enjoyed that very much. And so we see in the preceding chapters, the first miracle that he records is in the 4th chapter, and it's an unclean spirit. And he throws an unclean spirit out of a man. And then the next one is Peter's mother. It says that she had a major fever. And he took that out of her, Jesus did, and she got up and served them. It must have been a convention like this. And then it goes on. One of the things that impressed me the most in the fifth chapter, when it's talking in verse 12 about Jesus healing a leper, it's the first mention of Jesus specifically dealing with a leper. And the powerful word there is touch. Jesus touched the leper. You realize what that means? There's this man that's reputed to be diseased like no other disease on the face of the earth at that time, and Jesus touches him. It was forbidden. That's the kind of Jesus that we want to see. So this progresses to chapter 7, and there are four stories there that I think are a beautiful microcosm of Jesus' work. And that's our legacy as people who call themselves followers of Christ. So the first story, why is this one of the greatest? Well, because Jesus says so. He says that this man's faith was like no one else's he'd ever seen. Incredible, superlative statement, right? I'd like to read it. It's Luke 7, verse 1 through 10, and I'm reading from Barclay. When Jesus had finished telling the people what he wanted them to hear, he went to Capernaum. There was a centurion there whose slave was so ill that there was no hope for his recovery. This slave meant a great deal to him. He heard about Jesus and sent a party of Jewish elders to him with a request that Jesus should come and save his slave's life. They came to Jesus with an urgent appeal. "He deserves to have you do this for him," they said, "for he loves our nation, and it was he who built our synagogue for us." Jesus started out with them, but when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent some friends with a message to him. "Don't trouble yourself, sir," he said. "I am not fit to have you come into my house." This is the message that the messengers are giving. "That is why I did not even think myself fit to approach you personally. All I ask you to do is say the word, and so to answer my prayer that my servant should be cured. I know what it is to be under authority. I have soldiers under my command. I am used to saying to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come here,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and he does it." Jesus was astonished to hear this. He turned to the crowd which was following him. "I tell you," he said, "not even in Israel have I met faith like this." When those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in perfect health. This is the greatest example of faith that Jesus had encountered. Just think about it briefly. You know what the Jews would have called this man? They would have called him a Gentile dog. You know, in the kingdom, it's going to be a lot of surprises. That's what that phrase is all about. The first shall be last. The last shall be first. Secondly, this man didn't have to see to believe. He was so confident in Jesus' abilities and integrity, intentions, he knew that if Jesus said the word, it would be done. That's incredible when you think about it. And the third thing that I love about this story is this centurion's incredible humility. he didn't even have the self-confidence or whatever you want to call it that he came and made the request. This was a very important and wealthy man. And he sent Jewish leaders. He sent his other servants. It's a great story. The second incident happened shortly after this. Why is this one a great story? Well, I think from what I can see in the record, this is the first time that Jesus brought somebody back to life. He had done a lot of miracles. I think only a fraction of them are recorded because the scriptures will say, and he did many healings. They say that before this incident. But it seems like this is the first time that someone is brought back to life. Now, one of our favorite stories is the story of Lazarus. If you came up to me and said, well, that should be in this chapter, I wouldn't argue with you. It needs to be at the end of the story, but it's a great story too. It's just not in chapter 7. So here's the first time someone is brought back to life. Now, why this person? I'm curious about this. I don't have an answer. There must have been dead people around in Jesus' experience and in his beginning of his preaching. But there was something here. It was the circumstance. They were coming into the city and they meet the funeral procession. It can't be the first time they came close to dead people. But in this circumstance, they came up to him, they crowd, and they poured out their hearts. They said, there was this poor woman. She only had one son. He was taking care of her. Now he's dead. I don't know if we can imagine what it's like to have a loved one brought back to life. I want you to let your imaginations go for a minute here. And I want you to picture one person in your life and just imagine if they were brought back to life right now. Could you just picture what it would be like if they walked in the door? That's what happened here. Well, picture two people. If you can't pick one, pick two. Maybe it's your mother and your father. Well, picture a larger group. Maybe it's a class. Can you imagine if all those Bible students from 50 years ago in L.A. were brought back to life? Do you get some of the feeling of what it is for someone to come back into your life? Jesus reacted to this situation. He brought this young man back to life. Yeah, that's how we see Jesus. The third story is about John the Baptist. And, you know, John sends some of his disciples to ask Jesus, are you the one to come? Now, we've talked about this before, haven't we? Do you really think that John didn't know? You know, you can see two sides. Was John, because he was not going to be part of the gospel age, or the spirit-begotten era, was his faith just not sure? Was he not sure? Or, which the other option that I've heard, which I like a lot better, he was actually trying to get his disciples away from their dependency on him and trying to kind of nudge them over to Jesus. To me, that makes a little bit more sense. But they come and they say, John's question is, are you the one that we are to be waiting for? Or will there be someone else? And of course, Jesus' answer in verse 22 of this chapter 7 is very touching. He's talking about sending messengers back to his cousin. They grew up together. He said, go and tell John the story of all that you have seen and heard. Blind men are seeing again. Lame men are walking. Lepers are being cleansed. Deaf men are hearing. Dead men are being raised to life. Poor men are hearing the good news. Now, what I find astounding is that Jesus, when he was saying goodbye in John chapter 14, remember our theme text was in 17, that was the prayer, but the preceding four chapters were about the last night together. In that 14th chapter, which is the chapter of encouragement, Jesus says to them, you're going to do greater things than I did. Now, look at this list of what Jesus did. This is one of the most beautiful scriptures. I mean, if you wanted one scripture that capsulized Jesus' life, this is it. Blind, deaf, lame, dead. We're going to do more than this. Well, you've probably heard a very good explanation. I'm not sure where it came from, but I heard it first from my father. I'm not sure he originated it, but what could be better than giving a deaf person their hearing, a blind man their sight, a dead person their life? What could be better than that? You know the answer. Giving everyone life, giving everyone sight. In the kingdom, that's what's going to be better, is that it's multiplied millions and millions of times over. Billions. Jesus must have healed thousands of people in his lifetime. And just in that short 3.5 years. The record is many times says, and he did healings of multitudes. Verse 36 is our fourth story. And this is a story for the ages. Do they get better or are they all just good? This is the greatest story. And this is the story of the woman and the alabaster box. The situation is that Jesus is at a banquet at the house of a rich man. And I don't exactly understand the sociology there, but somehow other people would come in to the banquet. And there was this woman here, and she literally poured out her life savings as a kindness to Jesus because she loved him so much. And you know that this inspired a great poem that gets across one of the points here. And in verse 47, it says that although this woman has sinned greatly, her sins are forgiven. And it doesn't end there. There's a because she has loved greatly. I think the poem encapsulates the story so well. Do not keep the alabaster boxes of your love and tenderness sealed up until your friends are dead. Fill their lives with sweetness. Speak approving, cheering words while their ears can hear them, and while their hearts can be thrilled and made happier by them. The kind things you mean to say when they are gone, say them before they go. The flowers you mean to send, use to brighten and sweeten their homes before they leave them. If my friends have alabaster boxes laid away full of fragrant perfumes of sympathy and affection. I would rather they would bring them out in my weary and troubled hours and open them, that I may be refreshed and cheered when I need them. Let us learn to anoint our friends beforehand. Post-mortem kindness do not cheer the burdened spirit. Flowers cast no fragrant backwards over the weary way. One of the amazing parts about this poem is that this poem is known around the world. And it says that when Matthew records the event in Matthew 26:13, he records Jesus as saying, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what this lady has done will also be told in memory of her. So the lesson here is easy. It's giving from the depth of your heart. Secondly, we see that it deals with guilt. I don't know how you are on the guilt scale, but guilt's related to memory. If you have a decent memory, you're guilty. Because I remember things that I feel guilty about I did when I was 7 years old. And then I can almost catalog every year from then on. So here's a remedy for guilt. Guilt can be counteracted by actions of love. And the third lesson here is very much a lesson on judging. This woman, it says, doesn't just say she has a bad character. That's bad enough. It says she was notoriously bad. That means she was famous for being bad. Everybody in town knew that this was a bad character. Jesus said all of her sins were forgiven. So we have to hesitate in judging people of even notoriously bad character. And we see Jesus in this. We see him giving, expending his entire life. We see him helping and recognizing how the guilt could be remedied. And we see his masterful, the way he would judge a situation. So we might think about bringing that to today as far as our, in all respects of this story, giving while people are still with us, dealing with our own guilt, and being very cautious on judging others and ourselves. So this is the essence of the seventh chapter of Luke. I remember it just by thinking of the perfect stories. And then I remember the four perfect stories. I do enjoy intricacies. I do enjoy trying to figure out how much territory Israel will get before the kingdom is established. I do enjoy numbers. But I think of the simplicity of Jesus' message and his life. And I think of a song we used to sing when we were younger. We sang it to guitars, and the name of the song, or the verses went, put your hand in the hand of the man who calmed the waters. Put your hand in the hand of the man who calmed the sea. Put your hand in the hand of the man from Galilee. And sometimes I think that we try to act too grown up. We try to act too smart. And sometimes we need to act like we're children. Putting our hand in the Master's hand. You know, This was a man who would take children onto his lap and hold them. The disciples would be upset that Jesus would do things like that. But Jesus said, forbid them not. He encouraged the children to come. You can get such joy from children. Did I tell you maybe what was the highlight of my convention here? I think I meant to do that in the introduction, and I failed. I think the highlight of my convention was the session I spent with five of the young people. We talked about the Bible. We talked about Jesus. We talked about questions they had. If you want joy, you should see them. Get excited and see them explain things about truth and reality. That's Jesus. He saw children. He loved children. Sometimes we need to act as children. I think, in summary, that's the best way to get into the kingdom of heaven. Is to keep your focus on Jesus. Study his words. Study his life. Keep that the major portion of your efforts. May God help us all.